We are continuing today with our series with the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm delighted now to welcome to the air Devin Fuchs. He's a federal public defender in Albuquerque. Barbara Creel is a former public defender. She's a professor at the University of New Mexico Law School with a focus on Native American issues. And Judge Michael Vigil, he's a retired district judge from Santa Fe. Welcome everybody to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're here to talk about economics, race, and crime. We talk about, on this series, we're talking about so many different things like prison conditions and what happens when people get out of prison. But why people land in prison in the first place? There is so much disparity about that and so much injustice about that. First of all, the United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. Why is that?
I think in at least on the federal side, I can't speak as well to the state side. A lot of the federal prison sentences can be attributed I think there's been a general shift away from probationary sentences towards, and I think there's been a general shift in the way that criminal justice is viewed, away from a more reformative form of justice and kind of shifting towards mostly punitive. A lot of that has to do with the drug war, the war against drugs, I should say, that began in the 80s and continues today.
And so the idea is that we shouldn't reform people, even though 95% of them are going to get out of jail, as we learned last week, you should simply punish them.
I don't want to cast too broad a net here, and again, I'm speaking on my own personal experience, and I'm not speaking as a representative of the Federal Defender's Office, but only in my role as a federal defender. But it seems to me in my discussions with my colleagues that there has been a recognizable shift in terms of trying to actually really tend to the base causes of some of the criminality towards strictly punishing it. Which is not to say that no attempts are made. It just seems that there's been a general shift away from making those attempts.
For me, it's important to note that we still have the death penalty. The federal death penalty, and then certain states still honor...
Not in New Mexico, thank you.
Yeah, certain states still honor that death is an acceptable punishment. So when you start with that, then throwing someone in jail is seen as mercy. And it's the exact opposite. Instead of focusing on, as Devin said, the rehabilitative and corrective, restorative justice, the United States has had a heightened focus on punitive and punishment, especially with the war on drugs in the 80s. But it's for natives, it started from the very beginning with the idea that the United States was a lawful land, and Indians on and off the reservations, before reservations were invented, were a criminal element to be dealt with and had to be exterminated. So that there's definitely an economic and a racial and a crime and punishment component to all of those for Native Americans that started from very first contact. Indians were criminalized from the very beginning. They put on reservations, but also it evolved in that the Bureau of Indian Affairs, once that was established, created crimes for being an Indian. So speaking your own language, performing Sundance were all criminalized in the Code of Federal Regulations. It's this part of United States history that we don't learn about in our schools, but it was just the fact that natives were too Indian and could be punished for that. Incarceration, your rations were taken away from you, and all sorts of other hard labor punishments.
So this is a multi-generational, widespread American story and American trauma. What do you see as the legacy of that in your work right now, both as a public defender and now as a professor in law school?
The legacy is easy to see with a higher minority element behind. The United States has a prison population problem, but most of those people are people of color. And so that has, as we've seen in the popular press, people of color have been criminalized in a way that we're just now beginning to talk about. That's always been true.
And I think, just to follow up on something Barbara said, I think it's something like maybe 2/3 of all people in prison, I believe, are people of color. So
yeah,
there's an issue there, and there's a reason for that.
Well, when you talk about, I mean, two of you sitting here at the table, Native person, African American person, both major centuries-old traumas that are still playing out today. I often say that we've been fighting the Civil War for 300 years and it's not over yet. I mean, what does that look like for you as a public defender, Devin?
Well, it's interesting because in New Mexico, it's, you know, I don't practice in New York City where there's a tremendously high African American population. And funny enough, most of the disparity that I see on a day-to-day basis is actually deals with Hispanics or Latinos. And I see it just in terms of most of the crimes that we see, aside from the immigration crimes, you really start to drill down on the disparities when it comes to federal sentencing laws, and particularly as they relate to drug offenses. And it's really, the issue is kind of complex, but it kind of breaks down to a couple of things. The Sentencing Reform Act of, I believe, 1984 or 1987, I can't remember.
But it was a Reagan era.
That's right.
Thing.
And we all know what was going on at the same time with the war on drugs. And then also the promulgation of the federal sentencing guidelines, which came shortly after, and they went into effect, I believe, in 1987, I want to say, but they didn't, it wasn't until 1989 where it was kind of universal. And the purpose of the guidelines was to create a more uniform manner of sentencing and to decrease sentencing disparities, but the effect of them has been actually to increase the sentencing disparities, particularly in the area of drug sentences.
And it seems like police are a lot more active in poorer neighborhoods, in African-American neighborhoods, in essentially non-white neighborhoods, and so you're going to get more people arrested in places where cops are active.
Sure, and I think that's a really good point. I think that that's an area that's somewhat glaring, in my opinion, is when it comes to things like crack cocaine. And, you know, I guess as a primer, I should just say a little bit maybe about the federal sentencing guidelines, just so people have an idea of what we're dealing with and how they work. The federal sentencing guidelines it's a grid. On one axis, there is what's known as the offense level. Every crime that you commit in the federal system has an offense level attached to it. And the other axis would be the individual defendant's criminal history score. The criminal history score is dependent on your prior convictions and, more importantly, how much time you spent in jail or prison on each conviction. So the federal sentencing guidelines, which were mandatory up until 2005, took away a lot of discretion from the judges to sentence each individual as they saw fit, which was the purpose, because they didn't want an individual in one courtroom receiving a sentence that was remarkably different from someone in the courtroom next door charged with the same crime. So they implemented the guidelines in an effort to try to end those kinds of disparities. The sentencing guidelines as they apply to drugs are somewhat unique because your offense level, the seriousness of the crime, will vary based on what kind of drug it is. And in some instances, the purity of that drug. We see that a lot with methamphetamine. The purer the amount, the purer the methamphetamine, the higher your offense level is, and therefore the higher your sentence will be.
What that doesn't seem logical.
It is. It isn't, and it's more illogical when you see how it actually gets implemented. And I can circle back around to that in a minute. And it's also very logical when it comes to crack cocaine as well. And one of the biggest problems with crack cocaine, and this is getting back to your issue regarding people who are dealing drugs and so forth. And when the guidelines first came out, they treated 1 gram of crack cocaine was sentenced the same as 100 grams of powder cocaine.
And we know who was using each one.
That's right. And so that's why I say I don't think that they didn't intend to be discriminatory or to cause this disparity, but the disparity is there by the way that they're attaching blame.
Impacted African Americans, black people.
Obviously. Yeah. And going back to...
And someone wrote that law. I mean, consciously or unconsciously, there was a bias written into that law where white people are more likely to use cocaine, black people more likely to use crack cocaine, and so there you have 100-to-1 disparity.
Right. That, and I should say that has since been reduced. It might be 13-to-1 now, maybe.
Under Eric Holder, there was a sentencing reform of that particular.
But there's still that disparity still exists.
Yeah. And whether it was intentional or not, it doesn't matter. It ended up being completely discriminatory in its actions.
And so that affects the one axis of the sentencing guidelines, the offense level. But then, as you mentioned, people who are dealing crack cocaine are typically low income, lower in socioeconomic status, often African Americans, Hispanics, and it's much easier to detect someone dealing crack cocaine on the corner of their neighborhood than it is to capture someone who's dealing powder cocaine at high-end parties or what have you. I don't know where powder cocaine's really dealt, so that could be off base. But and so that results in individuals having higher criminal history, having greater criminal histories, and therefore a higher criminal history category on the sentencing guidelines. So even though it might not have been intended to be to have that effect, it most certainly does, and people of color are undoubtedly affected by it more so than others.
There's another piece that I want to talk about, which is that in neighborhoods where there is poor education, poor housing, and poor economic opportunity, then you have a place where, and I know people, I mean, I knew a woman who basically went to prison for selling drugs because that was the only way she knew how to support her kid. Because she was working a minimum wage job and actually couldn't get by, so she sold a little bit of pot on the side, got caught. Then, you know, the kid is motherless. I mean, it goes on like that. But the context surrounding, and I'm wondering if any of you can talk about this, the context surrounding things like drug crimes.
Well, you know, the most common denominator for people who appeared before me in state court, and fortunately, state court does not have the mandatory sentences that the federal courts have. Judges have wide discretion, but the most common denominator is poverty. It is so sad to see a family who is struggling financially and who lose hope in bettering their lives, turn to drug addiction, get hooked, and then have to sell drugs in order to be able to feed their own habit, and also maybe to try to make a better life for their children. But it's just a revolving door, and it becomes generational. I mean, at one point in my court, I had a grandfather, a father, and a son all in my court on drug charges. All of them hooked on heroin, and it had been going on for three generations, and they were all poor, and they were unemployed, and they had no education, and so these are what's encouraging for me is in New Mexico, we have turned away from incarcerating everyone, and we have programs now, a drug court program, mental health treatment program, different alternatives to prison. And I think when I first came on the bench 20 years ago, these programs were non-existent. So after a first attempt at probation, there were no other alternatives but prison. And as these programs develop, we're seeing huge success with these people, because we're treating their addiction, we're treating their mental health, we're treating their unemployment status by getting them into education or skills, and giving them hope again. Because you know, you send them to prison, and they become a more sophisticated criminal.
Now, those programs that you talk about, when people get out of them, do you see real changes? I mean, do you see them being able to turn their lives around? Heroin addiction is a very rough road to walk.
Oh, they're difficult. It's difficult, but yes, we see great successes. And you know, one of the joys for me now, I've been retired now 3 years, is running into those people on the street and finding that they are employed and that they're taking care of their children and that they're, you know, struggling still with the addiction. But now they have the tools and the ability that when they do fall off the wagon, they know where to get help and they know what they need to do to get back on track again, where before they had no skills, they had no tools to stay clean and sober. So yeah, I think it's really successful, the drug court and the mental health court that treats people with mental illness. For the longest time, our prisons and jails were places where we housed our mentally ill, and that is the worst place you can put a person who's mentally ill. In the treatment court, mental health treatment court, they learn about their mental illness, they learn how to cope with it, and they know what resources are available to help them when they go off their medication and they need help. So,
yeah. Now, we've been talking about Native people, African-American people. What about Latino people here in the state of New Mexico? What kinds of... I mean, it's a funny history because the Spanish were the conquerors here and played the dominant role in the city of Santa Fe and governing this area at the expense of the Native people who were here. Now the state has changed. It became the United States and so on. What do you see as the racial disparities, if you do, here in Santa Fe and in New Mexico?
Well, you know, again, it's still primarily people of color. But the other denominator, again, is poverty. I don't care if you're Native, Black, or Hispanic. If you're poor, the chances that you're going to end up in the criminal justice system are just huge.
Yeah. Native, Black, Hispanic, or white.
Right. Or white. So, you know, I think we're seeing, especially in a county like Rio Arriba County, which is has a heroin addiction problem that is just incredible. And again, the most of them, I would say 90% of the people that I dealt with in Rio Arriba County were Hispanic, poor Hispanic people with the same characteristics, no education, no job, no hope.
And the cultural trauma of having had their way of life, which was the land-based acequia way of growing food and having community, be completely supplanted.
Yeah, that's gone just about. You know, you have very few people that are still living that lifestyle.
So there's a recipe for crime, and it's pretty obvious. I mean, the data shows that poverty, lack of job opportunity, poor education, substance abuse, families that have been separated from their parents. All of this coalesces to provide the perfect storm for a person to grow up and face criminal activity. And Judge has seen it in his courtroom, the prison, the jail to the school to prison pipeline, where the children without these opportunities, and this is true on and off the reservations for Native people and people of color. And reservations are some of the poorest places in the nation, but you have that same recipe. It doesn't matter where it is. It's going to create a sense of hopelessness that then leads to substance abuse, that then leads to further crime and then punishment.
But all that being said, I think that for African Americans, at least as it relates to drug cases, I think they have a 20% higher chance of receiving a prison sentence as compared to a white counterpart. And I think for Hispanics, it's as high as 40%.
For the same crime?
For drug crimes, yeah.
And then natives are also part of the criminal justice system, both as victims and as defendants. So native men have a higher rate of victimization and incarceration. Native women have a higher rate of than their population in the total population should allow, a higher rate of, we hear this all the time, that Native people, Native women are more likely to be 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted. And so it's both sides. They're both facing crime, both as victims and defendants. So how do you explain that?
Yeah, and what's also interesting along with that, of the individuals who do actually get sentenced for drug crimes, I think that and I can't speak to the Native American population. I just don't have that much data that Barbara has. I'll leave that to her. But in terms of blacks and Hispanics, I think that on average, the blacks and Hispanic receive sentences that are, I think, on average about 10% higher than that of their white counterparts.
In New Mexico, the average sentence for a Native American convicted of a state assault was 6 months, and compared with an average of 54 months for a Native American in federal court.
Goodness.
So 6 months versus 54 months in a in the same or similar kind of assault. And I'm not talking about these issues because it's important to protect people who commit assault. I'm talking about them because of the disparities.
Of course.
If we're going to be tough on crime, it shouldn't be one person getting 6 months in state court and one person getting 5 years in federal court.
Now, as you said before, maybe there were some good intentions in sentencing guidelines to try to even things out, but it didn't really come out the way people
Not
had
for
intended.
People of color.
Yeah.
Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah. Now, Judge Michael Vigil, you have had situations where you saw kids who were in foster care, and then they ended up in your criminal court.
Yeah, I was there long enough, unfortunately, for me to see children that I dealt with in my first year on the bench in the neglect and abuse docket who had been 5 years old and had been removed and placed in foster care. And then later I saw them as juveniles in the juvenile children's court, and then I saw them now on their first felony as an adult at 18. You know, the amazing thing is that we can identify these children at birth that need the resources to really make a difference in their lives. And New Mexico ranks 49th on just about every category involving children. And we have this incredible fund, permanent fund, that is called the Rainy Day Fund, that the state refuses to tap into, which we should be using those monies to be assisting, identifying these children at birth and providing resources. And you're not going to get them all, but if you provide resources to these children, we won't lose them along the way. It's almost too late when they start getting into the juvenile justice system. So it's some, you know, and if it's a rainy day fund, it's raining.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is raining.
It is raining.
We see that in federal court. Adults who have grown up and are facing, you know, some really horrific crimes, don't get me wrong on this, and really long sentences. But when you look back at their background, they were that 9-year-old child that got raped by some neighbor or someone who had to take care of their mom because she was a heroin addict. We see these horrific stories, and nobody wants to think about it when they're a 27-year-old man in federal prison, but it's the same child.
Yeah.
Right, and just to, as a practical point, that's a lot of my job is pointing out to judges, to prosecutors, letting them know what the background is like, and that is something that the court is required to consider in imposing a sentence. But oftentimes it falls on deaf ears. You know, a lot of times it's a sob story, or, oh, your client didn't get hugged enough. A lot of prosecutors, I think, are numb to those kinds of arguments. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to speak, obviously, for the United States Attorney's Office, but it seems to me from where I stand that a lot of it is policy-driven and politically driven. And sometimes they hear, they understand what's going on in a defendant's life, but their hands are tied because there's some policy.
And I agree with Judge that we can identify these children at birth with the social determinants of health and the psychologists and the doctors who are, you know, creating the ACE scores, the adverse childhood experiences scores, that then determine what their criminal involvement will be at a later life. We should be spending all our money on that part.
We're talking to Devin Fuchs, Barbara Creel, and Judge Michael Vigil. And one of the things that I was thinking about in preparing to talk to you guys was the idea of, like, the analogy to healthcare, picking up on what you guys were saying about how you can identify kids young. In healthcare, we talk about the prevention of disease through eating well and exercise and sleep and so on. In law enforcement and the criminal justice system and really the health of communities, we could be talking about that too. I mean, just as you said, Barbara, a moment ago, that there is a formula for crime, there's also a formula for non-crime, presumably, namely good education, work opportunities, treating people equally. Seems like you'd save an awful lot of money doing that, just in the same way that, you know, eating healthy and staying healthy means that you don't have to be treated quite as much for dread diseases, right? You're preventing those, doesn't cost you time and money and agony and human suffering. Why as a country, I know this is a big question, but why as a country have we not gotten to that consciousness? Where it just seems like we're just so far from it.
Well, you know, I think you're starting to see a change actually at the federal level, where they're talking about amending the sentencing guidelines. And what's causing it is what you just said, is that it's costing taxpayers money to house all of these prisoners in all of these prisons. And you see this never-ending. And so finally, you actually have Republicans in Congress who are open to changing these laws so that people aren't doing these incredible sentences. But where you really need a change is in the educating society or the community that resources are better spent building schools, building daycare centers, feeding children. Children are starving. They're going to sleep at night hungry. That shouldn't happen in this country. And the result is going to be we're going to be shutting prisons down, not building new prisons. And that's going to save incredible amounts of money. And we're going to have productive citizens. You have to educate the populace that this is the way to go.
Yeah,
and then you have the private prison system, which is dead set against that.
Oh, it's a moneymaker.
Sure. And I think that the issue's been highly politicized instead of at the detriment of a common sense approach to limiting criminal activity, especially when it comes to drugs. I think that no politician wants to be the politician who introduces a bill to reduce federal mandatory minimum sentences, which is something that the United States Sentencing Commission has actually recommended. They recommended some time ago that some of the mandatory sentences be reduced. Congress has just failed to act. I think it's because it's a political issue, and no one wants to be the one who has to go through the next election cycle with their opponent telling them, the populace, that they're weak on crime.
Yeah. The ironic thing that I found in my research is that natives have ended up in federal court because of a case that led to the Major Crimes Act in 1885, or 1887. In 1885, individual on the Dakota Reservation killed another Indian. And at that time, jurisdiction didn't allow for the United States to impose the federal death penalty on an Indian country when the person had been punished by the local law of his tribe. And the case is called Crow Dog. Crow Dog was punished under the traditional Sioux justice system, for lack of a better word, that was restorative, and it was community-based, and it was swift, and it was punishment. But it was focused on bringing the person back, the family back into a position where they could live without the person who had been murdered, and making the person who committed the murder accountable to the rest of the community. And so he was sentenced to provide horses, blankets, money, and there's an oral history that says he was even banished for a certain period of time, the murderer. When Congress heard this, they learned that the victim was an individual who was an Indian agent and an Indian, and so they were outraged that there wasn't the federal, federal component. The United States had tried to try the individual under the federal death penalty, but the Supreme Court said no jurisdiction. And that's when Congress came in and created the Major Crimes Act that required jurisdiction to be literally tough on Indians and murder on the reservation. We'll come around to full circle today. What we're realizing is that this punishment doesn't work, either because it's way too costly, and when you're a fiscal conservative, that's a great argument to go to, but also doesn't work. It's recidivism is really off the charts. When you look at restorative justice system, recidivism goes down 98% to where you have little. And when you do it dealing with community-based policing and restorative justice, it is amazing. So we have a federal judge in Pennsylvania who's looking at one of my colleagues' work, Cheryl Fairbanks, in restorative justice. He's a circuit judge or a federal magistrate in Pennsylvania, and they're literally looking to the native practices on restorative justice because it's the right thing to do.
Well, and it's so practical, and one of the things that I'm learning through doing this series on the criminal justice system is that we're not a very practical nation, at least on a political level. We act out of emotion and passion, we act out of ideology, we act out of all sorts of Freudian unconscious, biases and prejudices and ideas about what's right and wrong. But when you look at something as practical as giving some people blankets and food, what do you need to live and go forward? And what do you need to restore this person who did something bad to a place where they're not going to do it again? I mean, that's just a simply practical thing that came out of a very long-standing community tradition, which exists in a lot of different places in the world.
Yeah, restorative justice is a great model. I had the opportunity to use that in my court, and it just makes a whole lot of sense. One of the most successful cases that I had in a sentencing circle was where a young juvenile had struck a police officer and had been charged with assault on a police officer. We got the family together. We got the officer to agree to come to the circle. And the change that occurred, the officer hearing the child tell the officer about how horrified he was and scared he was of officers because of what he had seen in his past, and then the child finding out what it was like for the officer to go out every day and have to face all of these dangerous situations. The big change there is that where before, where the child would see this particular officer and would be afraid of him, after that sentencing circle, they became friends.
Yeah.
And he would look him out and call the child in, and they would talk, and how's your day, and it really broke that stereotype that was going to go on forever until you know, the child ends up in prison eventually when they become adults and they're still striking out at police officers. But that model is so good, you know. And,
yeah.
and I use the problem in state court is that we have to have everyone agree.
And it takes
prosecutors,
time.
Yeah, prosecutors don't like it.
And it takes time. It's really a healing process that requires everyone to buy in, right?
Exactly.
But it also is much more time-consuming than our, you know, plead them guilty, sentence on, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, and Barbara probably knows about this better than I do, but at least on the Navajo Reservation, they actually have something called Peacemaker Court, which is, from all accounts, I understand, can be incredibly helpful. And,
it's a parallel to the court system. It's a
right.
peacemaker system that is integrated in their traditional justice systems, which many, like you said, many places around the world have a traditional way of dealing with community violations that was supplanted by the United States criminal justice system. And I'm a big fan of the Constitution and civil rights and due process, but there's lots of room for improvement when it comes to crime and punishment.
When we talk about economics, race, and crime, which is the subject of our conversation today, there is a factor which I think it's important to talk about, which is anger. Anger at injustice, anger at the system, anger if you are a kid walking down the street and you get frisked for no reason. Or I was reading, they sent a SWAT team. A SWAT team went into a school, I think it was in South Carolina, and they were pinning 14-year-old children on the ground, handcuffing them. It turned out it was like one kid had been suspected of having drugs. They sent a SWAT team into a school. And they don't do that in white schools in the suburbs ever. And, you know, they use SWAT teams, for example, to serve warrants or to, you know, pick somebody up for, you know, a small drug offense. And it's like a show of, I want to say, almost not only force but kind of arrogance. And if you're on the receiving end of that, not only as a person but as a community, as a class, as a race, as a, you know, culture, subculture here in the United States of America, what do you do with that anger? I mean, I've heard stories of people who let that fester to the point where it leads to them doing things that they wouldn't otherwise have done. I mean, comments?
Well, it seems to me that anger that you speak of is anger that is embodied primarily in the people who are suffering those same injustices. I suppose my point is that if you are not directly affected by that, then it tends to become that's not my problem, that happened in the next town over, that certainly doesn't happen where I live, and then it's kind of, it's almost like out of sight, out of mind, that's not my life, that's not something I have to deal with, and I think people tend to kind of ignore what's going on with their neighbors if they're different from them, if they don't look like them, if they don't speak the same language as they do. And so the people who, unfortunately, it seems like people who really have the power to do something by nature of their rights to vote, and those who, more importantly, who actually exercise it, are the ones who they're not really seeing it. They're not. If it doesn't affect me, then it's not really an issue that I have to contend with. And it's not until your son or your house gets raided because little did you know your son at college was dealing, you know, whatever, cocaine on the side, does it become real to you. And without that reality striking home for a lot of the voting populace, I think it just becomes a them problem. That's their problem, not mine. Mm-hmm.
And it's what you were mentioning earlier, that the centuries of trauma that's really clear in our Native communities, and the militarization. That actually, Indian Affairs Office was under the War Department until the early 1800s, and the forcible removal of men, women, and children in off of their native lands onto reservations, the criminalization of being Indian, the Major Crimes Act, that is a hit after hit after hit to where we get to the point now where we have natives in prison getting higher sentences. And it's as Devin said, at some point, people who aren't being faced with that are feeling like, oh, that's happened a long time ago, and why don't they just get over it? And they become numb to it. And
It really isn't until they experience for themselves some injustice. For me, I don't like to talk about all the negative things that happen to natives because it supplants it or it overshadows all the wonderful, healthy communities and families that I know and love. But there's no doubt about it that as a minority-majority state, we have more minority people in jail being, and it's not because we're bad people. It's because of the system and the way that it's been set up.
Well, you were talking before we went on the air, Barbara, about there's a kind of double or even triple jeopardy because of jurisdictions for Native people.
Yeah, it's a system that doesn't apply anywhere else in the United States that Native people can face punishment on their own reservation and for the same crime face punishment in federal court. And oftentimes without an attorney in tribal court and with an attorney in state or federal court, what happens then is that their criminal histories get overblown because they have the same crime that are being punished for in two different sovereigns. That's potentially, that could happen in state, federal, but it's really rare. And the federal government has a policy called the Pettit policy, where either the state will take the case or the feds will take the case, not both, which just isn't true in the federal tribal scheme. And
so
natives will do a sentence in their tribal, they'll get sent to tribal jail. The tribe will pay $80 a day to send someone to county jail. For a year, that's almost $30,000. That's a lot of money for a poor pueblo or tribe to be operating. And then they'll get switched over to Devin's office, be picked up by the feds, and be facing the same a different punishment for the same incident.
Yeah, and that does happen not infrequently. And as Barbara knows, and Barbara actually contacted me on a case that I was working on out of the Santo Domingo Pueblo, where my client received a year-long sentence, and the federal government decided that it was not enough, and so they decided to prosecute him in federal court as well. And
that's so double jeopardy.
Well, it isn't, and that's probably another discussion for another day. But it certainly to me almost seems overly paternalistic in
yeah.
some ways. In other words, we'll show you how people should be punished and.
But this is after they've taken away jurisdiction and then told them, and then restored it in a way that says that your jurisdiction has to look like this, and so they've taken away all the restorative, reparative, native traditional justice, and then left them with double jeopardy.
Right, and I feel like they're saying, "Well, your type of justice is not enough."
It's not funny, but it becomes so ridiculous.
Right, I was going to say it's not humorous, but it's ridiculous.
Well, there's another thing going on, and this is something that you, as you were saying before, Devin, deal with all the time, is that there are people here from, like, Mexico and Latin America who cross the border illegally, and then they get caught, and that's a civil penalty. They get sent to civil prison where they, an immigration prison, which is another growth industry, apparently, these days, where they don't have the right to a lawyer. Eventually, if they're deported, sometimes they come back for whatever reason to work or to be with their families. And when they come back, it's a crime. And then you are put in the position of defending them.
That's correct. And that's a healthy portion of any federal defender or any federal practitioner, criminal practitioner's caseload is defending illegal reentry cases, which are particularly difficult from a defense perspective because there's a lot of times there's just not a whole lot you can do. You know, the civil side isn't really my bailiwick. I mean, they intersect at some point, but I'm just dumb enough to know that if I have a case that has real civil implications, and I can refer my client to an immigration attorney or someone who's certainly more talented in that area than I am. But you know, all those people, they receive prison sentences. Yeah, I think that there's an impression in the public that we're just releasing people who are in the country illegally, which just isn't true. And I should say without permission, because that's the actual crime is reentry without permission. So it's really frustrating, especially because once you have received one of those convictions, for illegal reentry. It's almost impossible to ever get legal permission to return, which becomes a really heartbreaking situation a lot of times, where you see, for example, an individual who was perhaps brought to this country when they were an infant by their parents who were from Mexico, and has grown up here, has gone to high school here, but for one reason or another, their parents never naturalized and never had them naturalized. And then all of a sudden, they're removed from something happens. Law enforcement finds out they're not a citizen, or they're a citizen of another country, and they get removed to a country where they've probably never been before. And sometimes they don't even speak the language. And their response is that the same as mine would be. It should be to return. But then every time you return, whenever you get caught, first off, it's a life of looking over your shoulder the entire time, waiting for if you get pulled over, and then officer's going to find out that you're not in the country with permission, and that you've been removed before. Every time that you come back, your sentence just keeps getting higher and higher and higher and higher and higher, and it's really heartbreaking for some people. A lot of the clients that we deal with, it's just heartbreaking because what else are they going to do?
I mean, what else are they? I mean, yeah. That is the question that seems to be unanswered.
Or if your family lives here, maybe you immigrated here and you've started a family. You've got two kids. They go to Alamosa Middle School or whatever. They're doing great, and then you get removed. Your children are United States citizens. You are not. You get removed. Well, you know what? You're coming back. You know, and I can't say I blame them. Mm-hmm. You're coming back.
We've got just a couple of moments left, and I'd like to end with this question. It's a question that I like to ask, which is, if you had a magic wand and you could make the system work better, what are one or two things that you would do? Judge Vigil?
Well, I think I touched on it a little bit, that we need to concentrate our resources on the very, very, very newborn baby, where we identify them as young children that we know are going to struggle because they are living in poverty, because their parents aren't educated, maybe their parents are addicted to some substance. If we poured resources into their lives, it would make a difference, and we would not have this cradle-to-prison pipeline that has been in place for so many years, and we just don't do anything about it.
If I could wave a magic wand, I think I'd probably swap the budget for the Department of Defense and put that into education, and then ask that they operate with the same amount of funding that schools are getting.
Nice. Barbara?
I can't agree more with my two colleagues, and focusing on children is has to be priority. And that sounds pretty simple, but I think that's true. One thing we didn't talk about with juveniles in the federal system as well, native juveniles and immigration juveniles. And I think making a better life, putting more money into early childhood education, would be much better spent than money building prisons.
Devin Fuchs is a federal public defender in Albuquerque. Barbara Creel is a former public defender and a professor at the University of New Mexico Law School. Judge Michael Vigil is a retired district judge here in Santa Fe. They're all part of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.